May it please the court. I'm Michael Francisco, attorney registration number 39111, and I represent the appellants, Dean Freeman and Tradewinds Group, LLC. The district court wrongly held Dean Freeman personally liable for the debt of a limited liability company. Only 9 times in the history of this state have Colorado courts used the drastic remedy of piercing the corporate veil. As the Colorado Supreme Court recently held, this harsh rule is reserved for, quote, extraordinary circumstances. This is not an extraordinary case. The district court must be reversed, most prominently, because when Dean Freeman received a corporate distribution in October 2007, it could not, as a matter of law, have defeated a rightful claim, which appellee Mr. Martin did not have until late 2009.
But it was a potential claim. At that point, the LLC was in litigation. It certainly knew of the potential for liability for costs. It had posted a cost bond, so there was a contingent liability there.
Yes, Your Honor, there was a contingent liability. However, it was not a liability that was actually a debt to the limited liability company.
I didn't see in your briefs any cite to any case that says that the liability must exist at the time of the alleged transfer. I didn't see any case. In fact, I found cases that say it doesn't have to. Not in Colorado, but elsewhere. It can be a contingent liability. As long as you know about it, the possibility of liability. Let's say you have a contract. I'll give you a hypothetical. And you have perhaps you've breached the contract, but no claim has been asserted. So you don't. There's no real existing liability, but in that sense, you can't at that point say, oh no, I better get my assets out of the corporation so that my corporation isn't liable on this contract.
Your Honor, if I may, I think there are two responses. The first is that a nature of a cost bond is different than a potential liability on a contract, and I would point to the Ferrellgas decision where the Supreme Court recently said that litigation costs are not an inherent part of the underlying factual dispute between the parties, but rather they arise as a result of the dispute actually proceeding to litigation. So I think it's particularly a different type of liability here. But secondly, perhaps more importantly, I would point the court to the district court's order at page 11, when the district court found that in October 2007, the court was convinced that Dean Freeman was not aware of any impropriety or financial recklessness of the transfer. The court was persuaded that, to the best of his knowledge, all of the known or reasonably possible debts of the entity were fully provided for at the time of the distribution. And in that context, there was no fraud being perpetrated and there was no abuse of the corporate form. The second prong of veil-piercing analysis requires the corporate form itself to be abused to defeat a rightful claim. And when the court found that at the time of the distribution, all reasonably known or possible debts were taken care of, Mr. Freeman was not abusing the corporate form to receive that distribution. As it happened, 2 years later, the corporation did come to owe a debt because of a series of contingent events. The case went to trial, there was a jury verdict, it was reversed. And in fact, this is a situation perhaps not unlike many other limited liability companies when in 2007, somebody would have taken a distribution and then with events unfold 2 years later, almost 3 years later in fact, the corporation comes to owe a debt. And there are no veil-piercing cases in Colorado which have allowed that type of a look back to undo corporate transactions that happen without any reasonable connection to the debt owed. The cases where the veil has been pierced have been situations when there was an act of fraud committed or when the court found that somebody was using the corporate form improperly, knowing that there was an actual debt that existed for the purpose of defeating the claim. In this case, the claim didn't exist. It was a very hypothetical or contingent possibility. There was no counterclaim ever asserted, so this was not even the typical litigation case or a common litigation case in which you would think that you need to account for the potential damages on a counterclaim. There were no potential damages.
Are you arguing that the portion of defeating a valid claim has to be done with intent to defeat that claim. In other words, although the parties did not know at the time that all the assets of the limited liability company were distributed to Freeman, that there was a specific claim. But you're saying that the law requires that the transfer be made with the intent, as in a fraud, with the intent to defeat a claim. Or is it just that the LLC, if its existence is upheld, then defeating a valid claim without the intent to defeat the valid claim when the transfer is made doesn't satisfy the statute? Is that your argument?
Not exactly, Your Honor. What I would try to point to is under the second prong of the Oprah analysis, all parties and courts have agreed with a couple propositions. The first proposition being that the mere inability of a corporation to pay a debt is not enough to satisfy the second prong, which second prong requires either showing a fraud, which would have intentionality, or abuse of the corporate form to defeat a rightful claim. My contention is that in this case, the abuse of the corporate form to defeat a rightful claim, that necessarily entails using the corporate form in an improper way with some connection to that defeating a rightful claim. In 2007, there was no, quote, rightful claim, unquote. There was something that happened.
But the parties were involved in litigation, and when the parties are involved in litigation, there is the potential for a rightful claim.
Yes, Your Honor, the potential for a rightful claim, but to abuse the corporate form to defeat a rightful claim, it would need to be more than a potentiality. And again, in this case, I would say that there was so much time between this distribution in 2007 and the time that the claim existed, that as the district court found, Mr. Freeman was acting very reasonable. There was nothing reckless about it. In no sense was he draining assets to defeat a judgment that had existed. This is not a case like Great Neck Plaza, where somebody is moving assets after a judgment has already been entered to try to keep that from being collected.
Well, is your answer then, yes, it does take intent to defeat a rightful claim when the assets are removed from the limited liability company? You're saying it does take intent. And without intent to defeat the rightful claim, that prong is not satisfied.
You know, I would answer by saying I believe it takes a reasonable relationship, as the court in McCollum described it under the second prong. And intent would satisfy a reasonable relationship, although you don't necessarily have to show intent in all cases.
Would the reasonable relationship that you're positing here exist merely by virtue of the fact that the transfer was made while litigation was going on? Because if this transfer had been made before any kind of lawsuit might have been filed, that would certainly be a factor that would weigh in your favor, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, if there were active counterclaims in the lawsuit, I would agree. However, this is a highly unique situation when you had a breach of contract claim where there were no counterclaims and there was not any situation, that litigation, that would have made it reasonable for Mr. Freeman to not take the distribution. The undisputed facts show that he was the sole member of the LLC. He made the capital contribution for this capital purchase of the LLC originally, and thus it was natural for him to take a distribution when it sold that asset. And again, I would say in this case, the district court found that there was nothing reckless about it. I could understand where there would be some litigation situations when it would be unreasonable and it could be reckless to take a distribution in the midst of litigation.
Now, you're using reckless and posited the approach that it had to be, there had to be a reasonable relationship, not a reckless relationship or anything else. It just had to be a reasonable connection between the two. So aren't we doing what Judge Ney was asking about by saying, well, there's got to be an element of intent or recklessness or reckless disregard? You seem to be saying that's true, as opposed to the reasonableness concept that you earlier articulated.
Your Honor, if I may, the reasonableness comes from the reasonable relationship that the abuse of the corporate form plays to the rightful claim. The wording of the analysis from the courts is that it has to be abuse of the corporate form which defeats a rightful claim.
There's plenty of evidence of abuse of the corporate form here. Didn't Judge Prince make a number of findings that Mr. Freeman essentially disregarded the corporate form?
Your Honor, the factual findings are not contested in this case. However, when he analyzed in the order the second prong, the only fact he relied upon was this 2007 distribution. And if I may, I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is Murray Wiener from Colorado Springs, and my number, bar number, is 14352. What I'd like to do briefly is just simply comment on the record for 1 second, and then go right to Judge Jones' question regarding the creditor-debtor relationship, which I think is really what we're all talking about here when we talk about the second prong. First of all, I think this court has been handicapped to a large degree by the fact that the record, the appellant didn't provide a copy of the trial transcript, which had the witnesses testifying. And of course, Chief Judge Davidson issued an order in this case which made rather clear, as the law is, that there's a presumption that the evidence supported the trial court's findings, Judge Prince's findings, and that if the appellee fails to provide material portions of the record and the trial transcript, of course, would be that he does so at his own risk. And in this case, I don't think there really can be a mistake about it. What's really going on here is we have, in disguise, an appeal from the factual findings of Judge Prince. And he wrote a 13-page opinion, as you saw. And we all know that from reviewing his opinion and just knowing the law in this area, that the concept of veil piercing is intensely factual. It is intensely factual. And Judge Prince went through the 8 illustrative factors set forth in the Phillips case and the McCallum case and all the other cases. But the point I'm making is that in this case, you don't have the benefit of the trial transcript to see all the little details. Obviously, the timing I can tell from the questions, we have that. We have a June 5th, 2006 lawsuit filed by Tradewinds against Martin. We have one asset, an airplane, which is sold in October 2007 in the midst of this litigation for $274,000 net recovery, and that money goes directly to Freeman's pocket, as Judge Prince said. We have I don't remember the month, I think it was April 2008 trial, and I would, talking about whether or not my client was a creditor, had a potential claim, a claim, or anything else, and the answer is, of course, yes. I'm going to talk about that for a second, and then I'm going to get to the distinction, which doesn't exist in my mind, between a counterclaim and the fact that there's this cost statute. But let me talk for a second about when my client started incurring costs. A lawsuit gets filed on June 5th of 2006. My client subsequently responds to the complaint. Immediately, you have to file and you have to pay this court system, you have to pay to be able to file an answer or an entry of appearance. And of course, LexisNexis starts charging you the second you push the button. So the cost started incurring. We were a creditor, my client was a creditor of Mr. Freeman. It had a condition subsequent. We had a win in order for the cost statute to kick in. But that's no different than a counterclaim. If my client asserted a counterclaim against Tradewinds, and Tradewinds considered it worthless, or maybe they considered it meritorious. Either way, I still had to win for that counterclaim to turn into money. But either way, I was a creditor. Let me give 2 or 3 examples of a creditor-debtor relationship, just to show how we use these terms. A bank issues a line of credit to my law firm. We rarely use the line of credit. but the bank is the creditor and my law firm is the debtor, irrespective of whether or not on a given day we've drawn on the letter of credit. Another example would be a subcontractor, general contractor scenario. I'm a bricklayer. I do work for a general contractor. On the 25th of the month, I submit a draw request. The general contractor pays on time, and I get paid around the 1st. At that moment, I'm not owed anything. But I'm a creditor in this relationship. I'm a creditor, and the general contractor is the debtor. And then we go on, and it goes up and down. The point here is that my client was a creditor from the beginning. There was a condition. We had a win. But the point is that we were a creditor, and we were incurring costs before they sold the plant. So, and of course, we didn't know they sold the plane, but they sold the asset. So my first point, again, is that we don't have a record here to see all the details, and that's the presumption is that the record supports. And the second point is that Martin was a creditor of Freeman. Whether you call it a contingent liability or whatever you call it, it's a creditor-debtor relationship. I think that Mr. Freeman is misstating, and quite in a big way, misstating the second element or prong of the three-part test set forth in Veil Piercing. It is not, as Judge Terry said in the McCallum case, which is a really important case for a lot of reasons, but the main reason it's important is because she takes all the law in Veil Piercing, Colorado, but it's a comprehensive kind of case as opposed to an individual case. And in that case, she's going through the first element and second element, and in discussing the second element, she says there's no additional requirement to prove any conduct specifically directed at the plaintiff creditor, Martin. Martin was just one of the litigation creditors, as Judge Prince said. He was a potential litigation creditor. The Roth River Law Firm, which was paid over $200,000 by Freeman, they were in that boat. The expert witnesses that they called at trial who were doing their work behind the scenes, they were in that boat. There were other people in that boat. When Freeman, or Tradewinds, which is really the same thing as Judge Prince found, when he took the only asset it had, $274,000 worth of a plane, and liquidated it, and proceeded with a mere assetless shell, as Judge Prince said, what he did is it was sort of a heads I win, tails you lose concept. They litigate a case with a shell corporation. If they win, they can get money from Martin, and they can get costs from Martin. If they lose, they say, we don't have any money. And Freeman pays the bill. But the point is that it was the act of liquidating the assets during this litigation, which was not specifically aimed at Martin, but was aimed at any creditors, or litigation creditors, or any other creditors of Tradewinds. And the only other standard she sets forth in the McCallum case is the creditor must show an effect on its lawful rights resulting from abuse of the corporate form. What's the effect? The corporation was a mere assetless shell. That's the effect. There is no intent element, unless you're going to prove the other side, the fraud element. It's, did it defeat, or did the abuse of the corporate form defeat the rightful claim? And the answer is yes.
Well, counsel, the case is, though, if you go back, and McCallum didn't really discuss this, but in looking at the second prong, the cases use language to the effect that the abuse of the corporate form must be to defeat public convenience or to justify or protect wrong, fraud, or crime. Other cases say it has to be defeat public convenience, justify wrong, or protect fraud, or justify or protect a wrong, fraud, or crime. So it's not enough that there is a cause and effect. There has to be a wrong, fraud, or crime, it seems to me. And didn't Judge Prince find that there was nothing improper about the transfer of the funds when they were made? I mean, you raised that claim specifically, and he rejected it.
Well, I don't think he said there was nothing wrong about the transfer from putting it into his own pocket. Remember, he said that it was used by the other company, Aircraft Storage, and then he also said that the plane, there was no even reference to Tradewinds on the paperwork, that the money went into Freeman's own pocket, that there was no reserve.
But that's, what do you expect? It's a sole member LLC. I mean, that's what happens. I mean, that's not unusual. If that was the sole asset of the LLC except for the claim, so doesn't it make sense that the sole member is going to get the proceeds of the sale of the sole asset of the LLC?
Well, Judge, we're dealing with legal fictions here, of course, and the answer, sure, of course, is if you cut through everything, ultimately the answer, of course, is yes. But that doesn't mean necessarily that when Tradewinds is sitting there asserting in our court system and using our court system to prosecute a claim. And I think if you step back and go up to 30,000 feet, I think Judge Prince is reacting in large part to what I said before, this heads I win, tails you lose concept of using our court system for one purpose and when it's depleted. But I think that the wrong here is the fact that they're already in litigation, they deplete, and the section that my colleague talked about, page 11, really relates to the knowledge concept, nothing else. So that was a separate claim, a distribution claim. But when you look at what happened here is they depleted in the midst of this litigation everything from this company, knowing, as he said, that they could have litigation expenses, that they could have sanctions imposed against them and those things. So I think that the wrong is, in the midst of litigation, Judge Casebolt said, what if it occurred prior to the litigation? And I think, quite frankly, that might be, it depends on the facts and it depends on the fact finder, but it might be a different case. It certainly would be a better argument for the appellant here, if this transfer occurred before there was litigation or before there was a claim related to litigation, it certainly would. But Judge, I do think that the wrong is the fact that in the midst of litigation, where costs can go either way, as an example, and we can even make this stronger. What if there was a prevailing party attorney's fees statute as opposed to a cost claim?
But there wasn't here. Why don't we stick to what the facts are? I mean, this is all about costs.
Right.
And there's a cost bond. If you thought the cost bond was insufficient, you could have moved the court for a higher cost bond.
I think two things on that. First of all, the record isn't complete here about what happened. And they have completely misstated what happened here. What happened here, and parts of this part is in the record that I'm about to say, what happened here is real simple. An out-of-state corporation must post a cost bond. They didn't post a cost bond. Martin filed a motion requiring a cost bond. The statute, of course, caps things at $5,000. The instantaneous reaction, unilaterally, and it's in the record, was to file a $500 cost bond unilaterally without talking to anybody. So they filed a $500 cost bond. Of course, Martin doesn't know anything about the assets or the nature of Tradewinds and issues associated with Freeman and Tradewinds and all the facts we know now that are in this opinion. But either way, he unilaterally submits $500, and the judge issues a handwritten little order that says approved.
But you know, as litigation's going on, you've got far more than $500
in
costs, and you never move to increase the cost bond.
Well, but the problem is that you don't know that Tradewinds is an assetless shell, number one. You know that the statute caps things at $5,000. I note in the appellant's brief, they cite no law whatsoever that the cost bond statute, the interrelationship between the veil piercing, common law veil piercing, and the cost bond statute, any law saying that should be a cap. But how would you know as a litigant? How would you know as a litigant that Tradewinds is a shell until you find out the facts, which you're not going to find out in a case about liability over a hangar at the Colorado Springs Airport? So, and the judge just signed it, as judges do, and the cost bond statute is, as you know, nobody, it gets done right away. The other thing I should say is the record's clear on this. The appellant incurred $36,000 in costs, and and Martin incurred $35,000. So everybody knew on both sides that costs in this case. I mean, in the underlying case, as you can see from the underlying opinion, which Judge Carbarelli wrote, they sought $777,000, and costs went up. There were experts and all of that. So my point mostly is that I don't think the cost bond statute relates to any of this, and the reason is that even if we got it all the way up to $5,000, it wouldn't make a difference. But you have no knowledge at the time of the cost bond statute of the economics of the plaintiff. You just don't know, and you have no way of knowing. You can't do discovery on that.
So just to make sure I understand what the heart of this is on the second prong, so your contention is that the wrong, and there has to be a wrong, is the transfer of assets while there is litigation ongoing in which there is the potential for the award of costs.
No, I would modify that just slightly. It's not just towards me. It's not just towards Martin, because remember, in the McCallum case, it's not saying you have to have they had to know about my client. It's towards all litigation creditors. For example, the Roth River Law Firm, which ultimately was paid $200,000 by Freeman personally. It's the experts who were obviously paid a big chunk of the $36,000. It's not towards my costs. It's towards litigation creditors or creditors of the corporation as a whole. It just happened that it affected me because, as Judge Prince pointed out, the only one Freeman decided to treat differently was Morton. So it's not the cost bond statute only comes in because that's how it affected my rights, but it's towards everyone. I think in Judge Carparelli, in the original decision, cited Freeman's testimony, which is in the record, where Freeman testified that Trademans was just a piece of paper sitting on a shelf. That was his quote, and Judge Carparelli cited it in the opinion. And that's what Judge Prince was essentially saying, the same thing in lots more detail. I should note, again, and I'll stop at this, there were findings of fact regarding the fact that Martin was a creditor. I put that in a footnote on I forget what page, but on page 6, 7, 9, and 10 of Judge Prince's opinion, he refers to Martin as Trademans Colorado creditor, Trademans creditor, the creditor's claim, and the remaining litigation creditor. So clearly Judge Prince saw Martin as a creditor, and again, we don't have the record or the transcript of the trial in order to see the details of that. If there are no further questions, I'll rest.
Your Honors, I would like to summarize what I believe is the main point in this case, and that is the result below holds Dean Freeman as an individual person liable for a corporate debt, which disturbs the rule of limited liability. And to do that, they rely upon something that he did, taking a distribution from a corporation, which in these undisputed facts was not unreasonable. It was not only not fraudulent, it was reasonable. And I would again call you to the district court's finding that when he took the distribution, this is at page 12, all of the known or reasonably possible debts, not just debts, reasonably possible debts of the entity were fully provided for. And when that is the factual finding, I believe the Colorado law of veil piercing does not allow an individual to be held liable. He posted a cost bond as was required. It did not go objected to. And when he took the distribution, he did so when all of the debts, the possible debts, were fully provided for. That is reasonable activity that he should not be held personally liable for. Thank you.
I don't think possible. I think he said own debt.
Your Honor, if I may check quickly. Just to make sure that I had the quote from the district court's order correctly.
I can look it up, actually.
On page 12, it does say, all the known or reasonably possible debts, Your Honor. The word
reasonably possible.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. This case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.